fingers, wave dismissal.
Let this be your kingdom, most exquisite of queens, and let me be your king. I will give you a throne of gold if you like. When Karth begins to pall, we can journey around Yiti and search for the dreaming city of the poets to sip the wine of wisdom from a dead man's skull.
I mean to sail to Westeros and drink the wine of vengeance from the skull of the usurper. She scratched Rhaegal under one eye, and his jade-green wings unfolded for a moment, stirring the still air in the palanquin. A single perfect tear ran down the cheek of Zarazoan Daxus.
Will nothing turn you from this madness?
Nothing, she said, wishing she was as certain as she sounded. If each of the 13 would lend me 10 ships,
you would have 130 ships, and no crew to sail them. The justice of your cause means naught to the common men of Karth. Why should my sailors care who sits upon the throne of some kingdom on the edge of the world?
I will pay them to care.
With what coin, sweet star of my heaven?
With the gold the seekers bring.
That you may do, Zara acknowledged, but so much caring will cost dear. You will need to pay them far more than I do, and all of Karth laughs at my ruinous generosity.
If the 13 will not aid me, perhaps I should ask the Guild of Spices, or the Tourmaline Brotherhood. Zaro gave a languid shrug.
They will give you nothing but flattery and lies. The Spices are dissemblers and braggarts, and the Brotherhood is full of pirates.
Then I must heed Pyat Pri and go to the Warlocks. The merchant prince sat up sharply.
Pyat Pri has blue lips, and it is truly said that blue lips speak only lies. Heed the wisdom of one who loves you. Warlocks are bitter creatures who eat dust and drink of shadows. They will give you naught. They have naught to give.
I would not need to seek sorcerer's help if my friend Zarazoan Daxus would give me what I ask.
I have given you my home and heart. Do they mean nothing to you? I've given you perfume and pomegranates, tumbling monkeys and spitting snakes, scrolls from Lost Valyria, an idol's head and a serpent's foot. I have given you this palanquin of ebony and gold and a matched set of bullocks to bear it. One white as ivy and one black as jet with horns inlaid with jewels.
Yes, Danny said, but it was ships and soldiers I wanted.
Did I not give you an army, sweetest of women? Huh? 1,000 knights, each in shining armor?
The armor had been made of silver and gold, the knights of jade and beryl and onyx and tourmaline, of amber and opal and amethyst, each as tall as her little finger. 1,000 lovely knights, she said, but not the sort my enemies need fear. And my bullocks cannot carry me across the water. Why are we stopping? The oxen had slowed notably. Khaleesi, Aego called through the drapes as the palanquin jerked to a sudden halt. Danny rolled onto an elbow to lean out. They were on the fringes of the bazaar, the way ahead blocked by a solid wall of people. What are they looking at? Jogo rode back to her.
A fire mage, Khaleesi.
I want to see.
Then you must.
The Dothraki offered a hand down. When she took it, he pulled her up onto his horse and sat her in front of him, where she could see over the heads of the crowd. The fire mage had conjured a ladder in the air, a crackling orange ladder of swirling flame that rose unsupported from the floor of the bazaar, reaching toward the high latticed roof. Most of the spectators, she noticed, were not of the city. She saw sailors off trading ships, merchants come by caravan, dusty men out of the red waste, wandering soldiers, craftsmen, slavers. Jogo slid one hand about her waist and leaned closer.
The milkman shunned him, Khaleesi. Do you see the girl in the felt hat? There, behind the fat priest. She is a...
Cutpurse, finished Danny. She was no pampered lady, blind to such things. She had seen cutpurses aplenty in the streets of the free cities during the years she'd spent with her brother, running from the usurper's hired knives. The mage was gesturing, urging the flames higher and higher with broad sweeps of his arms. As the watchers crane their necks upward, the cut purses squirm through the press, small blades hidden in their palms. They relieve the Prosperous of their coin with one hand while pointing upward with the other. When the fiery ladder stood 40 feet high, the mage leapt forward and began to climb it, scrambling up hand over hand as quick as a monkey. Each rung he touched dissolved behind him, leaving no more than a wisp of silver smoke. When he reached the top, the ladder was gone, and so was he. "A fine trick," announced Jogo with admiration.
"No trick," a woman said in the common tongue.
Danny had not noticed Quaithe in the crowd, yet there she stood, eyes wet and shiny behind the implacable red lacquer mask. "What mean you, my lady?"
"Half a year gone, that man could scarcely wake fire from dragon glass. He had some small skill with powders and wildfire, sufficient to entrance a crowd while his cut purses did their work. He could walk across hot coals and make burning roses bloom in the air. But he could no more aspire to climb the fiery ladder than a common fisherman could hope to catch a kraken in his nets."
Danny looked uneasily at where the ladder had stood. Even the smoke was gone now, and the crowd was breaking up, each man going about his business. In a moment, more than a few would find their purses flat and empty. "And now?"
"And now his powers grow, Khaleesi, and you are the cause of it."
"Me?" she laughed. "How could that be?" The woman stepped closer and laid two fingers on Danny's wrist.
"You are the mother of dragons, are you not?"
"She is, and no spawn of shadows may touch her." Jogo brushed Quaithe's fingers away with the handle of his whip. The woman took a step backward.
"You must leave this city soon, Daenerys Targaryen, or you will never be permitted to leave it at all."
Danny's wrist still tingled where Quaithe had touched her. "Where would you have me go?" she asked.
"To the north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow."
"A Shai," Danny thought. "She would have me go to a Shai." "Will the Shai give me an army?" she demanded. "Will there be gold for me in a Shai? Will there be ships? What is there in a Shai that I will not find in Karth?"
"Truth,"
said the woman in the mask, and bowing, she faded back into the crowd. Ricaro snorted contempt through his drooping black mustachios. "Khaleesi, better a man should swallow scorpions than trust in the spawn of shadows who dare not show their face beneath the sun. It is known." "It is known," Aegor agreed. Zarozo and Daxus had watched the whole exchange from his cushions. When Danny climbed back into the palanquin beside him, he said,
"Your savages are wiser than they know. Such truths as the Ashai hoard are not like to make you smile."
Then he pressed another cup of wine on her and spoke of love and lust and other trifles all the way back to his manse. In the quiet of her chambers, Danny stripped off her finery and donned a loose robe of purple silk. Her dragons were hungry, so she chopped up a snake and charred the pieces over a brazier. "They are growing," she realized as she watched them snap and squabble over the blackened flesh. "They must weigh twice what they had in Vaes Taloro. Even so, it would be years before they were large enough to take to war. And they must be trained as well, or they will lay my kingdom waste." For all her Targaryen blood, Danny had not the least idea of how to train a dragon. Sir Jorah Mormont came to her as the sun was going down.
"The Pureborn refused you?"
"As you said they would. Come sit, give me your counsel." Danny drew him down to the cushions beside her, and Jiqui brought them a bowl of purple olives and onions drowned in wine.
"You will get no help in this city, Khaleesi." Sir Jorah took an onion between thumb and forefinger. "Each day I'm more convinced of that than the day before. The Pureborn see no farther than the walls of Karth. And Zaro..."
"He asked me to marry him again."
"Yes, and I know why."
When the knight frowned, his heavy black brows joined together above his deep-set eyes. "He dreams of me day and night," she laughed.
"Forgive me, my queen, but it is your dragons he dreams of."
Zaru assures me that in Karth, man and woman each retain their own property after they are wed. The dragons are mine. She smiled as Drogon came hopping and flapping across the marble floor to crawl up on the cushions beside her.
He tells it true, as far as it goes, but there's one thing he failed to mention. The Karthian have a curious wedding custom, my queen. On the day of their union, a wife may ask a token of love from her husband. Whatsoever she desires of his worldly goods, he must grant, and he may ask the same of her. One thing only may be asked, but whatever is named may not be denied.
One thing, she repeated, and it may not be denied?
With one dragon, Zaro Zern Daxus would rule the city, but one ship will further our cause but little.
Danny nibbled at an onion and reflected ruefully on the faithlessness of men. We passed through the bazaar on our way back from the Hall of 1,000 Thrones, she told Ser Jorah. Quaithe was there. She told him of the fire mage and the fiery ladder and what the woman in the red mask had told her.
I would be glad to leave the city, if truth be told, the knight said when she was done. But not for Ashai.
Where then?
East, he said.
I'm half a world away from my kingdom even here. If I go any farther east, I may never find my way home to Westeros.
If you go west, you risk your life.
House Targaryen has friends in the Free Cities, she reminded him. Truer friends than Zaro or the Pureborn.
If you mean Illyrio Mopatis, I wonder. For sufficient gold, Illyrio would sell you as quickly as he would a slave.
My brother and I were guests in Illyrio's manse for half a year. If he meant to sell us, he could have done it then.
He did sell you, Ser Jorah said, to Khal Drogo.
Danny flushed. He had the truth of it. But she did not like the sharpness with which he put it. Illyrio protected us from the usurper's knives, and he believed in my brother's cause.
Illyrio believes in no cause but Illyrio. Gluttons are greedy men, as a rule, and magisters are devious. Illyrio Mopatis is both. What do you truly know of him?
I know that he gave me my dragon eggs.
He snorted. If he'd known they were like to hatch, he would have sat on them himself.
That made her smile, despite herself. Oh, I have no doubt of that, sir. I know Illyrio better than you think. I was a child when I left his manse in Pentos to wed my sun and stars, but I was neither deaf nor blind, and I am no child now.
Even if Illyrio is the friend you think him, the knight said stubbornly, he is not powerful enough to enthrone you by himself. No more than he could your brother.
He is rich, she said. Not so rich as Zaro, perhaps, but rich enough to hire ships for me, and men as well.
Sellswords have their uses, Ser Jorah admitted, but you will not win your father's throne with sweepings from the Free Cities. Nothing knits a broken realm together so quick as an invading army on its soil.
I am the rightful queen, Danny protested.
You are a stranger who means to land on their shores with an army of outlanders who cannot even speak the common tongue. The lords of Westeros do not know you and have every reason to fear and mistrust you. You must win them over before you sail, a few at least.
And how am I to do that if I go east as you counsel?
He ate an olive and spit out the pip into his palm. I do not know, Your Grace, he admitted, but I do know that the longer you remain in one place, the easier it will be for your enemies to find you. The name Targaryen still frightens them, so much so that they sent a man to murder you when they heard you were with child. What will they do when they learn of your dragons?
Drogon was curled up beneath her arm, as hot as a stone that has soaked all day in the blazing sun. Rhaegal and Viserion were fighting over a scrap of meat, buffeting each other with their wings as smoke hissed from their nostrils. My furious children, she thought. They must not come to harm. The comet led me to Karth for a reason. I had hoped to find my army here, but it seems that will not be. What else remains, I asked myself. I am afraid, she realized, but I must be brave. Come the morrow, you must go to Pyat Pri. Tyrion. The girl never wept. Young as she was, Myrcella Baratheon was a princess born. And a Lannister, despite her name, Tyrion reminded himself, as much Jaime's blood as Cersei's. To be sure, her smile was a shade tremulous when her brothers took their leave of her on the deck of the Sea Swift. But the girl knew the proper words to say, and she said them with courage and dignity. When the time came to part, it was Prince Tommen who cried, and Myrcella who gave him comfort. Tyrion looked down upon the farewells from the high deck of King Robert's Hammer, a great war galley of 400 oars. Robb's Hammer, as her oarsmen called her, would form the main strength of Myrcella's escort. Lionstar, Boldwyn, and Lady Lyanna would sail with her as well. It made Tyrion more than a little uneasy to detach so great a part of their already inadequate fleet, depleted as it was by the loss of all those ships that had sailed with Lord Stannis to Dragonstone and never returned. But Cersei would hear of nothing less. Perhaps she was wise. If the girl was captured before she reached Sunspear, the Dornish alliance would fall to pieces. So far, Doran Martell had done no more than call his banners. Once Myrcella was safe in Braavos, he had pledged to move his strength to the high passes, where the threat might make some of the Marcher lords rethink their loyalties and give Stannis pause about marching north. It was purely a feint, however. The Martells would not commit to actual battle unless Dorne itself was attacked, and Stannis was not so great a fool. Though some of his bannermen may be, Tyrion reflected. I should think on that. He cleared his throat. You know your orders, Captain?
I do, my lord. We are to follow the coast, staying always in sight of land until we reach Crackclaw Point. From there, we're to strike out across the narrow sea for Braavos. On no account are we to sail within sight of Dragonstone.
And if our foe should chance upon you nonetheless?
If a single ship, we are to run them off or destroy them. If there are more, the Boldwyn will cleave to the Sea Swift to protect her while the rest of the fleet does battle.
Tyrion nodded. If the worst happened, the little Sea Swift ought to be able to outrun pursuit. A small ship with big sails, she was faster than any warship afloat, or so her captain had claimed. Once Myrcella reached Braavos, she ought to be safe. He was sending Sir Aerys Oakheart as her sworn shield, and had engaged the Bravossi to bring her the rest of the way to Sunspear. Even Lord Stannis would hesitate to wake the anger of the greatest and most powerful of the free cities. Travelling from King's Landing to Dorne by way of Braavos was scarcely the most direct of routes, but it was the safest, or so he hoped. If Lord Stannis knew of this sailing, he could not choose a better time to send his fleet against us. Tyrion glanced back to where the rush emptied into Blackwater Bay and was relieved to see no sign of sails on the wide green horizon. At last report, the Baratheon fleet still lay off Storm's End, where Sir Courtney Penrose continued to defy the besiegers in Dead Renly's name. Meanwhile, Tyrion's winch towers stood three quarters complete. Even now, men were hoisting heavy blocks of stone into place, no doubt cursing him for making them work through the festivities. Let them curse. Another fortnight, Stannis, that's all I require. Another fortnight, and it will be done. Tyrion watched his niece kneel before the High Septon, to receive his blessing on her voyage. Sunlight caught in the crystal crown and spilled rainbows across Myrcella's upturned face. The noise from the riverside made it impossible to hear the prayers. He hoped the guards had sharper ears. The High Septon was as fat as a house and more pompous and long of wind than even Pycelle.
Enough, old man, make an end to it, Tyrion thought irritably. The guards have better things to do than listen to you, and so do I.
When at last the droning and mumbling was done, Tyrion took his farewell of the captain of Robb's Hammer.
Deliver my niece safely to Braavos, and there will be a knighthood waiting for you on your return, he promised.
As he made his way down the steep plank to the quay, Tyrion could feel unkind eyes upon him. The galley rocked gently, and the movement underfoot made his waddle worse than ever.
I'll wager they'd love to snigger.
No one dared, not openly, though he heard mutterings mingled with the creak of wood and rope and the rush of the river round the pilings.
They do not love me, he thought. Well, small wonder. I am well fed and ugly, and they are starving.
Bronn escorted him through the crowd to join his sister and her sons. Circe ignored him, preferring to lavish her smiles on their cousin. He watched her charming Lancel with eyes as green as a rope of emeralds around her slim white throat, and smiled a small sly smile to himself.
I know your secret, Circe, he thought.
His sister had oft called upon the High Septon of late to seek the blessings of the gods in their coming struggle with Lord Stannis, or so she would have him believe. In truth, after a brief call at the great sept of Baelor, Circe would don a plain brown traveler's cloak and steal off to meet a certain hedge knight with the unlikely name of Sir Osmond Kettleblack and his equally unsavory brothers, Osney and Osfrid. Lancel had told him all about them. Circe meant to use the Kettleblacks to buy her own force of sellswords. Well, let her enjoy her plots. She was much sweeter when she thought she was outwitting him. The Kettleblacks would charm her, take her coin, and promise her anything she asked. And why not, when Bronn was matching every copper penny coin for coin? Amiable rogues, all three. The brothers were in truth more skilled at deceit than they'd ever been at bloodletting. Circe had managed to buy herself three hollow drums. They would make all the fierce booming sounds she required, but there was nothing inside. It amused Tyrion no end. Horns blew fanfares as Lyanstar and Lady Lyanna pushed out from the shore, moving downriver to clear the way for Sea Swift. A few cheers went up from the crush along the banks, as thin and ragged as the clouds scuttling overhead. Myrcella smiled and waved from the deck. Behind her stood Ares Oakheart, his white cloak streaming. The captain ordered lines cast off, and oars pushed the Sea Swift out into the lusty current of the Blackwater Rush, where her sails blossomed in the wind. Common white sails, as Tyrion had insisted, not sheets of Lannister crimson. Prince Tommen subbed. You mew like a suckling babe, his brother hissed at him. Princes aren't supposed to cry. Prince Aemon, the Dragon Knight, cried the day Princess Nereus wed his brother Aegon, Sansa Stark said, and the twins, Sir Arryk and Sir Eric, died with tears on their cheeks after each had given the other a mortal wound. Be quiet or I'll have some Meryn give you a mortal wound, Joffrey told his betrothed. Tyrion glanced at his sister, but Cersei was engrossed in something Sir Balon Swan was telling her.
Can she truly be so blind as to what he is? He wondered.
Out on the river, Bold Wynne unshipped her oars and glided downstream in the wake of Sea Swift. Last came King Robert's Hammer, the might of the royal fleet, or at least that portion that had not fled to Dragonstone last year with Stannis. Tyrion had chosen the ships with care, avoiding any whose captains might be of doubtful loyalty, according to Varys. But as Varys himself was of doubtful loyalty, a certain amount of apprehension remained.
I rely too much on Varys, he reflected. I need my own informers. Not that I trust them either.
Trust would get you killed. He wondered again about Littlefinger. There had been no word from Petyr Baelish since he had ridden off for Bitterbridge. That might mean nothing or everything. Even Varys could not say. The eunuch had suggested that perhaps Littlefinger had met some misfortune on the roads. He might even be slain. Tyrion had snorted in derision.
If Littlefinger is dead, then I am a giant.
More likely, the Tyrells were balking at the proposed marriage. Tyrion could scarcely blame them.
If I were Mace Tyrell, I would sooner have Joffrey's head on a pike than his cock in my daughter.
The little fleet was well out into the bay when Circe indicated that it was time to go. Bronn brought Tyrion's horse and helped him mount. That was Podrick Payne's task, but they had left Pod back at the Red Keep. The gaunt sellsword made for a much more reassuring presence than the boy would have. The narrow streets were lined by men of the city watch, holding back the crowd with the shafts of their spears. Sir Jaslyn Bywater went in front, heading a wedge of mounted lancers in black ringmail and golden cloaks. Behind him came Sir Aaron Santigar and Sir Balan Swan, bearing the king's banners, the Lion of Lannister and the crowned stag of Baratheon. King Joffrey followed on a tall grey palfrey, a golden crown set upon his golden curls. Sansa Stark rode a chestnut mare at his side, looking neither right nor left, her thick auburn hair flowing to her shoulders beneath a net of moonstones. Two of the king's guard flanked the couple, the Hound on the king's right hand, and Sir Mandon Moore to the left of the Stark girl. Next came Tommen, snuffling, with Sir Preston Greenfield in his wide armor and cloak, and then Cersei, accompanied by Sir Lancel and protected by Meryn Trant and Boris Blunt. Tyrion fell in with his sister. After them followed the High Septon in his litter and a long tail of other courtiers, Sir Horace Redwine, Lady Tander and her daughter, Jalabar Zo, Lord Giles Rosby and the rest. A double column of guardsmen brought up the rear. The unshaven and unwashed stared at the riders with dull resentment from behind the line of spears. I like this not one speck, Tyrion thought. Bronn had a score of sellswords scattered through the crowd with orders to stop any trouble before it started. Perhaps Cersei had similarly disposed her kettleblacks. Somehow Tyrion did not think it would help much. If the fire was too hot, you could hardly keep the pudding from scorching by tossing a handful of raisins in the pot. They crossed Fishmonger Square and rode along Muddy Way before turning onto the narrow, curving hook to begin the climb up Aegon's High Hill. A few voices raised a cry of, "Joffrey! All hail! All hail!" as the young king rode by, but for every man who picked up the shout, 100 kept their silence. The Lannisters moved through a sea of ragged men and hungry women, breasting a tide of sullen eyes. Just ahead of him, Cersei was laughing at something Lancel had said, though he suspected her merriment was feigned. She could not be oblivious to the unrest around them, but his sister always believed in putting on the brave show. Halfway along the route, a wailing woman forced her way between two watchmen and ran out into the street in front of the king and his companions, holding the corpse of her dead baby above her head. It was blue and swollen, grotesque, but the real horror was the mother's eyes. Joffrey looked for a moment as if he meant to ride her down, but Sansa Stark leaned over and said something to him. The king fumbled in his purse and flung the woman a silver stag. The coin bounced off the child and rolled away under the legs of the gold cloaks and into the crowd, where a dozen men began to fight for it. The mother never once blinked. Her skinny arms were trembling from the dead weight of her son. "Leave her, Your Grace," Cersei called out to the king. "She is beyond our help, poor thing." The mother heard her. Somehow the queen's voice cut through the woman's ravaged wits. Her slack face twisted in loathing.
"Whore!" she shrieked. "Kingslayer's whore! Brother fucker!"
Her dead child dropped from her arms like a sack of flour as she pointed at Cersei.
"Brother fucker! Brother fucker! Brother fucker!"
Tyrion never saw who threw the dung. He only heard Sansa's gasp and Joffrey's bellowed curse, and when he turned his head, the king was wiping brown filth from his cheek. There was more caked in his golden hair and spattered over Sansa's legs.
"Who threw that?"
Joffrey screamed. He pushed his fingers into his hair, made a furious face, and flung away another handful of dung.
"I want the man who threw that," he shouted. 100 golden dragons to the man who gives him up." "He was up there,"
someone shouted from the crowd. The king wheeled his horse in a circle to survey the rooftops and open balconies above them. In the crowd, people were pointing, shoving, cursing one another and the king.
"Please, Your Grace, let him go," Sansa pleaded.
The king paid her no heed.
"Bring me the man who flung that filth,"
Joffrey commanded.
"He'll lick it off me, or I'll have his head. Dog, you bring him here."
Obedient, Sandor Clegane swung down from his saddle,
but there was no way through that wall of flesh, let alone to the roof. Those closest to him began to squirm and shove to get away, while others pushed forward to see. Tyrion smelled disaster.
Clegane, leave off. The man has long fled.
I want him, Joffrey pointed at the roof. He was up there. Dog, cut through them and bring...
A tumult of sound drowned his last words, a rolling thunder of rage and fear and hatred that engulfed them from all sides.
Bastard! Someone screamed at Joffrey. Bastard monster!
Other voices flung calls of whore and brother fucker at the queen, while Tyrion was pelted with shouts of freak and half man. Mixed in with the abuse, he heard a few cries of justice and Rob, King Rob, the young wolf, of Stannis, and even Renly. From both sides of the street, the crowd surged against the spear shafts while the gold cloak struggled to hold the line. Stones and dung and fouler things whistled overhead.
Feed us! A woman shouted. Bread!
Boomed a man behind her.
We want bread, bastard!
In a heartbeat, 1,000 voices took up the chant. King Joffrey and King Rob and King Stannis were forgotten, and King Bread ruled alone.
Bread! They clamored. Bread! Bread!
Tyrion spurred to his sister's side, yelling.
Back to the castle, now.
Cersei gave a curt nod, and Sir Lancel unsheathed his sword. Ahead of the column, Jacelyn Bywater was roaring commands. His riders lowered their lances and drove forward in a wedge. The king was wheeling his palfrey around in anxious circles while hands reached past the line of gold cloaks grasping for him. One managed to get hold of his leg, but only for an instant. Sir Mandon's sword slashed down, parting hand from wrist.
Ride!
Tyrion shouted at his nephew, giving the horse a sharp smack on the rump. The animal reared, trumpeting, and plunged ahead, the press shattering before him. Tyrion rode into the gap hard on the king's hooves. Bronn kept pace, sword in hand. A jagged rock flew past his head as he rode, and a rotten cabbage exploded against the Mandan's shield. To the left, 3 gold cloaks went down under the surge, and then the crowd was rushing forward, trampling the fallen men. The hound had vanished behind, though his riderless horse galloped beside them. Tyrion saw Aeryn Santigar pull from the saddle, the golden-black Baratheon stag torn from his grasp. Sir Balon Swan dropped the Lannister lion to draw his longsword. He slashed right and left as the fallen banner was ripped apart, the 1,000 ragged pieces swirling away like crimson leaves in a storm wind. In an instant they were gone. Someone staggered in front of Joffrey's horse and shrieked as the king rode him down. Whether it had been man, woman, or child, Tyrion could not have said. Joffrey was galloping at his side, way-faced, and Sir Mandon Moore a white shadow on his left. And suddenly, the madness was behind, and they were clattering across the cobble square that fronted on the castle barbican. A line of spearmen held the gates. Sir Jaslyn was wheeling his lances around for another charge. The spears parted to let the king's party pass under the portcullis. Pale red walls loomed up about them, reassuringly high and aswarm with crossbowmen. Tyrion did not recall dismounting. Sir Mandon was helping the shaken king off his horse when Cersei, Tommen, and Lancel rode through the gates with Sir Meryn and Sir Boris close behind. Boris had blood smeared along his blade, while Meryn's white cloak had been torn from his back. Sir Balon Swan rode in helmetless, his mount lathered and bleeding at the mouth. Horace Redwine brought in Lady Tanda, half crazed with fear for her daughter Lollys, who had been knocked from the saddle and left behind. Lord Giles, more grey of face than ever, stammered out a tale of seeing the High Septon spilled from his litter, screeching prayers as the crowd swept over him. Jalabar Zoe said he thought he'd seen Sir Preston Greenfield of the King's Guard riding back toward the High Septon's overturned litter, but he was not certain. Tyrion was dimly aware of a maester asking if he was injured. He pushed his way across the yard to where his nephew stood, his dung-encrusted crown askew.
Traitors!
Geoffrey was babbling excitedly. I'll have all the heads, I'll...
The dwarf slapped his flushed face so hard the crown flew from Geoffrey's head. Then he shoved him with both hands and knocked him sprawling.
You blind, bloody fool! They were traitors!
Geoffrey squealed from the ground.
They called me names and attacked me.
You set your dog on them. What did you imagine they would do? Bend their knee meekly while the hound lopped off some limbs? You spoiled, witless little boy. You've killed Clegane and gods know how many more, and yet you come through unscathed. Damn you! And he kicked him. It felt so good, he might have done more. But Sir Mandon Moore pulled him off as Geoffrey howled, and then Bronn was there to take him in hand. Cersei knelt over her son, while Sir Balon Swan restrained Sir Lancel. Tyrion wrenched free of Bronn's grip.
How many are still out there?
He shouted to no one and everyone.
My daughter, cried Lady Tender. Please, someone must go back for lollies.
Sir Preston is not returned, Sir Boris Blunt reported, nor Aeron Centigar.
Nor Wet Nurse, said Sir Horace Redwine. That was the mocking name the other squires had hung on young Tyrek Lannister. Tyrion glanced around the yard. Where's the Stark girl? For a moment, no one answered. Finally, Geoffrey said,
she was riding by me. I don't know where she went.
Tyrion pressed blunt fingers into his throbbing temples. If Sansa Stark had come to harm, Jaime was as good as dead.
Sir Mandon, you were her shield.
Sir Mandon Moore remained untroubled.
When they mobbed the hound, I thought first of the king.
And rightly so, Cersei put in. Boris, Meryn, go back and find the girl.
And my daughter?
Lady Tander sobbed.
Please, sirs.
Sir Boris did not look pleased at the prospect of leaving the safety of the castle.
Your Grace, he told the Queen, the sight of our white cloaks might enrage the mob.
Tyrion had stomached all he cared to.
The others take your fucking cloaks.
Take them off if you're afraid to wear them, you bloody oaf. But find me Sansa Stark, or I swear I'll have Shagger split that ugly head of yours in two to see if there's anything inside but black pudding.
Sir Boris went purple with rage. You would call me ugly? You?
He started to raise the bloody sword still clutched in his mailed fist. Bronn shoved Tyrion unceremoniously behind him.
Stop it, Cersei snapped.
Boris, you'll do as you bid, or we'll find someone else to wear that cloak.
Your oath. There she is, Geoffrey shouted, pointing.
Sandor Clegane cantered briskly through the gates astride Sansa's chestnut courser. The girl was seated behind, both arms tight around the hound's chest. Tyrion called to her.
Are you hurt, Lady Sansa?
Blood was trickling down Sansa's brow from a deep gash on her scalp.
They were throwing things, rocks and filth, eggs. I tried to tell them I had no bread to give them. A man tried to pull me from the saddle. The hound killed him, I think. His arm...
Her eyes widened, and she put a hand over her mouth.
He cut off his arm.
Clegane lifted her to the ground. His white cloak was torn and stained, and blood seeped through a jagged tear in his left sleeve.
The little bird's bleeding. Someone take her back to her cage and see to that cut.
Maester Franken scurried forward to obey.
They did for Centigar, the hound continued. Four men held him down and took turns bashing at his head with a cobblestone. I gutted one. Not that it did Sir Aeron much good.
Lady Tander approached him.
My daughter.
Never saw her.
The hound glanced around the yard, scowling.
Where's my horse? If anything's happened to that horse, someone's going to pay.
He was running with us for a time, Tyrion said, but I don't know what became of him after that. Fire!
A voice screamed down from atop the barbican.
My lords, there's smoke in the city. Flee, bottoms, of fire!
Tyrion was unutterably weary, but there was no time for despair.
Bronn, take as many men as you need and see that the water wagons are not molested.
Gods be good, the wildfire. If any blaze should reach that.
We can lose all of Flea Bottom if we must, but on no account must the fire reach the guild hall of the alchemists. Is that understood? Clegane, you'll go with him.
For half a heartbeat, Tyrion thought he glimpsed fear in the hound's dark eyes.
Fire, he realized. The others take me, of course. He hates fire. He's tasted it too well.
The look was gone in an instant, replaced by Clegane's familiar scowl.
I'll go, he said, though not by your command. I need to find that horse.
Tyrion turned to the three remaining knights of the King's Guard.
Each of you will ride escort to a herald. Command the people to return to their homes. Any man found on the streets after the last peal of the Evenfall bell will be killed.
Our place is beside the king, Sir Meryn said, complacent. Cersei reared up like a viper.
Your place is where my brother says it is, she spit. The hand speaks with the king's own voice, and disobedience is treason.
Boris and Meryn exchanged a look.
Should we wear our cloaks, Your Grace? Sir Boris asked.
Go naked, for all I care. It might remind the mob that you're men. They're like to have forgotten after seeing the way you behaved out there in the street.
Tyrion let his sister rage. His head was throbbing. He thought he could smell smoke, though perhaps it was just the scent of his nerves fraying. Two of the stone crows guarded the door of the Tower of the Hand.
Find me Timot, son of Timot. Stone crows do not run squeaking after burned men,
one of the wildlings informed him haughtily. For a moment, Tyrion had forgotten who he was dealing with.
Then find me Shagga.
Shagga sleeps.
It was an effort not to scream, Wake him!
It is no easy thing to wake Shagga, son of Dorf, the man complained. His wrath is fearsome.
He went off grumbling. The clansmen wandered in, yawning and scratching.
Half the city is rioting, the other half is burning, and Shagga lies snoring, Tyrion said.
Shagga mislikes your muddy water here, so he must drink your weak ale and sour wine, and after his head hurts.
I have Shay in a manse near the Iron Gate. I want you to go to her and keep her safe, whatever may come.
The huge man smiled, his teeth a yellow crevasse in the hairy wilderness of his beard.
Shagga will fetch her here.
Just see that no harm comes to her. Tell her I will come to her as soon as I may. This very night, perhaps, or on the morrow for a certainty.
Yet by evenfall, the city was still in turmoil, though Bronn reported that the fires were quenched and most of the roving mobs dispersed. Much as Tyrion yearned for the comfort of Shay's arms, he realized he would go nowhere that night. Sir Jaslyn Bywater delivered the butcher's bill as he was supping on a cold capon and brown bread in the gloom of his solar. Dusk had faded to darkness by then, but when his servants came to light his candles and start a fire in the hearth, Tyrion had roared at them and sent them running. His mood was as black as a chamber, and Bywater said nothing to lighten it. The list of the slain was topped by the High Septon, ripped apart as he squealed to his guards for mercy.
Starving men take a hard view of priests too fat to walk, Tyrion reflected.
Sir Preston's corpse had been overlooked at first. The gold cloaks had been searching for a knight in white armor, and he had been stabbed and hacked so cruelly that he was red-brown from head to heel. Sir Aeron Santigar had been found in a gutter, his head a red pulp inside a crushed helm. Lady Tander's daughter had surrendered her maidenhood to half a hundred shouting men behind a tanner's shop. The gold cloaks found her wandering naked on Sour Belly Row. Tyrek was still missing, as was the High Septon's crystal crown. 9 gold cloaks had been slain, 20 wounded. No one had troubled to count how many of the mob had died.
I want Tyrek found, alive or dead, Tyrion said curtly when Bywater was done. He's no more than a boy, son to my late uncle, Tyget. His father was always kind to me. We'll find him, the Septon's crown as well. The others can bugger each other with the Septon's crown for all I care.
When you named me to command the watch, you told me you wanted plain truth, always. Somehow I have a feeling I'm not going to like whatever you're about to say, Tyrion said gloomily. We held the city today, my lord, but I make no promises for the morrow. The kettle is close to boiling. So many thieves and murderers are abroad that no man's house is safe. The bloody flux is spreading in the stews along Bisswater Bend. There's no food to be had for copper nor silver. Where before you heard only mutterings from the gutter, now there's open talk of treason in guildhalls and markets. Do you need more men? I do not trust half the men I have now. Slint, triple the size of the watch, but it takes more than a gold cloak to make a watchman. There are good men and loyal among the new recruits, but also more brutes, sots, cravens, and traitors than you'd care to know. They're half-trained and undisciplined, and what loyalty they have is their own skins. If it comes to battle, they'll not hold, I fear. I never expected them to, said Tyrion. Once our walls are breached, we are lost. I've known that from the start. My men are largely drawn from the small folk. They walk the same streets, drink in the same wine sinks, spoon down their bowls of brown in the same pot shops. Your eunuch must have told you there is small love for the Lannisters in King's Landing. Many still remember how your lord father sacked the city when Ares opened the gates to him. They whisper the guards are punishing us for the sins of your house, for your brother's murder of King Ares, for the butchery of Rhaegar's children, for the execution of Eddard Stark, and the savagery of Joffrey's justice. Some people talk openly of how much better things were when Robert was king, and hint that times would be better again with Stannis on the throne. In potshops and wine sinks and brothels, you hear these things, and in the barracks and guard halls as well, I fear. They hate my family. Is that what you're telling me? Aye, and will turn on them if the chance comes. Me as well. Ask your eunuch. I'm asking you. Bywater's deep-set eyes met the dwarf's mismatched ones and did not blink. You, most of all, my lord. Most of all. The injustice was like to choke him. It was Joffrey who told them to eat their dead. Joffrey who set his dog on them. How could they blame me? His grace is but a boy. In the streets, it is said that he has evil counsellors. The Queen has never been known as a friend to the commons, nor is Lord Varys called the Spider out of love. But it is you they blame most. Your sister and the eunuch were here when times were better under King Robert, but you were not. They say that you filled the city with swaggering sellswords and unwashed savages, brutes, who take what they want and follow no laws but their own. They say you exiled Janus Slint because you found him too bluff and honest for your liking. They say you threw wise and gentle Pycelle into the dungeons when he dared raise his voice against you. Some even claim that you mean to seize the Iron Throne for your own. Yes, and I am a monster besides, hideous and misshapen. Never forget that. His hand coiled into a fist. I've heard enough. We both have work to attend to. Leave me. Perhaps my lord father was right to despise me all these years, if this is the best I can achieve, Tyrion thought when he was alone. He stared down at the remains of his supper, his belly roiling at the sight of the cold, greasy capon. Disgusted, he pushed it away, shot it for Pod, and sent the boy running to summon Varys and Bronn. My most trusted advisers are a eunuch and a sellsword, and my lady's a whore. What does that say of me? Bronn complained of the gloom when he arrived, and insisted on a fire in the hearth. It was blazing by the time Varys made his appearance. Where have you been? Tyrion demanded.
About the king's business, my sweet lord.
Ah, yes, the king, Tyrion muttered. My nephew is not fit to sit a privy, let alone the Iron Throne. Varys shrugged.
An apprentice must be taught his trade.
Half the apprentices on Reeking Lane could rule better than this king of yours. Bronn seated himself across the table and pulled a wing off the capon. Tyrion had made a practice of ignoring
the sellsword's frequent insolences, but tonight he found it galling.
I don't recall giving you leave to finish my supper.
You didn't look to be eating it, Bron said through a mouthful of meat. City's starving. It's a crime to waste food. You have any wine?
Next he'll want me to pour it for him,
Tydian thought darkly.
You go too far, he warned.
And you never go far enough, Bron tossed the wingbone to the rushes. Ever think how easy life would be if the other one had been born first? He thrust his fingers inside the capon and tore off a handful of breast. The weepy one, Tommen. Seems like he'd do whatever he was told, as a good king should.
A chill crept down Tyrion's spine as he realized what the sellsword was hinting at.
If Tommen was king?
There was only one way Tommen would become king.
No, he could not even think of it.
Joffrey was his own blood, and Jaime's son as much as Cersei's.
I could have your head off for saying that, he told Bronn,
but the sellsword only laughed.
Friends, said Varys, quarrelling will not serve us. I beg you both, take heart.
Whose?
Asked Tyrion sourly. He could think of several tempting choices.
Davos. Sir Courtney Penrose wore no armor. He sat a sorrel stallion, his standard-bearer a dapple gray. Above them flapped Baratheon's crown stag and the cross quills of Penrose, white on a russet field. Sir Courtney's spade-shaped beard was russet as well, though he'd gone wholly bald on top. If the size and splendor of the king's party impressed him, it did not show on that weathered face. They trotted up with much clinking of chain and rattle of plate. Even Davos wore mail, though he could not have said why. His shoulders and lower back ached from the unaccustomed weight. It made him feel cumbered and foolish, and he wondered once more why he was here.
It is not for me to question the king's commands, and yet...
Every man of the party was a better birth and higher station than Davos Seaworth, and the great lords glittered in the morning sun. Silvered steel and gold inlays brightened their armor, and their war helms were crested in a riot of silken plumes, feathers, and cunningly wrought heraldic beasts with gemstone eyes. Stannis himself looked out of place in this rich and royal company. Like Davos, the king was plainly garbed in wool and boiled leather, though the circlet of red gold about his temples lent him a certain grandeur. Sunlight flashed off its flame-shaped points whenever he moved his head. This was the closest Davos had come to his grace in the 8 days since Black Betha had joined the rest of the fleet off Storm's End. He'd sought an audience within an hour of his arrival, only to be told that the king was occupied. The king was often occupied, Davos learned from his son, Devon, one of the royal squires. Now that Stannis Baratheon had come into power, his lordlings buzzed around him like flies around a corpse.
He looks half a corpse, too, years older than when I left Dragonstone.
Devon said the king scarcely slept of late.
Since Lord Renly died, he has been troubled by terrible nightmares, the boy had confided to his father. Maester's potions do not touch them. Only the Lady Melisande can soothe him to sleep.
Oh, is that why she shares his pavilion now?
Davos wondered. To pray with him? Or does she have another way to soothe him to sleep?
It was an unworthy question, and one he dared not ask, even of his own son. Devon was a good boy, but he wore the flaming heart proudly on his doublet, and his father had seen him at the night fires at dusk fell, beseeching the Lord of Light to bring the dawn.
He is a king's squire,
he told himself.
It is only to be expected that he would take the king's guard.
Davos had almost forgotten how high and thick the walls of Storm's End loomed up close. King Stannis halted beneath them, a few feet from Sir Courtney and his standard-bearer.
Sir,
he said with stiff courtesy. He made no move to dismount.
My lord...
That was less courteous, but not unexpected.
It is customary to grant a king the style Your Grace, announced Lord Florent. A red gold fox poked its shiny snout out from his breastplate through a circlet of lapis lazuli flowers. Very tall, very courtly, and very rich, the Lord of Brightwater Keep had been the first of Renly's bannermen to declare for Stannis, and the first to renounce his old gods and take up the Lord of Light. Stannis had left his queen on Dragonstone, along with her uncle, Axel. But the queen's men were more numerous and powerful than ever, and Alistair Florent was the foremost. Sir Courtenay Penrose ignored him, preferring to address Stannis.
This is a notable company. The great lords, Estamont, Errol, and Varna, Sir John of the Green Apple Fosseways, and Sir Brian of the Red, Lord Carron and Sir Gaillard of King Renly's Rainbow Guard, and the puissant Lord Alistair Florent, of Brightwater, to be sure. Is that your onion knight I spy to the rear? Well met, Sir Davos. I fear I do not know the lady.
I am named Melisande, sir.
She alone came unarmored, but for her flowing red robes. At her throat, the great ruby drank the daylight.
I serve your king and the Lord of Light.
I wish you well of them, my lady, Sir Courtenay answered, but I bow to other gods and a different king.
There is but one true king and one true god, announced Lord Florent.
Are we here to dispute theology, my lord? Had I known, I would have brought a scepter.
You know full well why we're here, said Stannis. You have had a fortnight to consider my offer. You sent your ravens. No help has come, nor will it. Storm's End stands alone, and I am out of patience. One last time, sir. I command you to open your gates and deliver me that which is mine by rights.
And the terms, said Sir Courtenay.
Remain as before, said Stannis. I will pardon you for your treason, as I have pardoned these lords you see behind me. The men of your garrison will be free to enter my service or to return unmolested to their homes. You may keep your weapons and as much property as a man can carry. I will require your horses and pack animals, however.
And what of Edric Storm? My brother's bastard must be surrendered to me. Then my answer is still no, my lord.
The king clenched his jaw. He said nothing. Melisande spoke instead. May the Lord of Light protect you in your darkness, Sir Courtenay.
May the others bugger your Lord of Light, Penrose spat back, and wipe his arse with that rag you bear.
Lord Alistair Florent cleared his throat.
Sir Courtenay, mind your tongue. His Grace means the boy no harm. The child is his own blood and mine as well. My niece Delano was the mother, as all men know. If you will not trust to the king, trust to me. You know me for a man of honour.
I know you for a man of ambition, Sir Courtenay broke in. A man who changes kings and gods the way I change my boots. As do these other turncloaks I see before me.
An angry clamour went up from the king's men.
Oh, he's not far wrong, Davos thought.
Only a short time before, the Fosseways, Gaillard Morrigan, and the lords Carron, Varna, Errol, and Estamont had all belonged to Renly. They had sat in his pavilion, helped him make his battle plans, plotted how Stannis might be brought low, and Lord Florent had been with them. He might be Queen Selyse's own uncle, but that had not kept the Lord of Brightwater from bending his knee to Renly when Renly's star was rising. Bryce Carron walked his horse forward a few paces, his long rainbow-striped cloak twisting in the wind off the bay.
No man here is a turncloak, sir. My fealty belongs to Storm's End, and King Stannis is its rightful lord, and a true king. He is the last of House Baratheon, Robert's heir, and Renly's.
If that is so, why is the Knight of Flowers not among you? And where is Mathis Rowan? Randall Tarley, Lady Oakheart, why are they not here in your company? They who loved Renly best. Where is Brienne of Tarth, I ask you?
That one? Sir Gaillard Morrigan laughed harshly. She ran, as well she might. Hers was the hand that slew the king.
A lie, Sir Courtney said. I knew.